listening
to the CD Baby.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
DIY.
Musician.
Musician podcast.
Hey there, and welcome to episode number 198 of the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast. My name is Kevin Bruner, and joining me is Chris Robley. Chris, how you doing?
I'm doing good. I released a single last week, and I was excited to test out CD Baby's, or I should say Show.co, just launched a pre-save feature for Spotify, and I tested that out, which was pretty cool.
How's it working for you?
It was good. Basically, if people don't know, this is turning it into an advertisement, which I don't mean it to, but basically a pre-save lets your fans pre-save your song on Spotify before it's actually launched. And then on the day that the song is officially released, the song is added to the song queue of all those people who click to hear it. So basically you kind of spike your first day stream count, ideally. So this, you know, is a real easy way to do that. And it went well. I went into the analytics of Spotify for Artists and checked, and I think like 35% of the plays of the song have come from people's song cues, which I'm assuming correlates to the pre-save people. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, not only does it spike your play counts, well, it gets the music added to their account and, you know, probably can randomly play and all that, but it also is a signal to the Spotify algorithm that lots of people are saving this album on the first day it's released, or this song. And so it really juices the algorithm there in a good way that works and is Spotify approved, which we will talk about later.
Yeah, yeah.
It's been a couple weeks since you and I've been on the podcast together because you were at Disneyland, or Disney World,
Disney
I should
World.
Say.
There's a difference.
Disney World. And I took some time and even time off from work and got a studio here in Portland, flew out our producer engineer, and finally got through all the remaining guitar parts of our new album. So we're pretty much just finishing up some vocal stuff, have a release date in the new year. I think we're going to do it right. I think we're doing it the right way. We'll see.
Now, I have a question. Did you set your release date before you have CDs in hand?
Yes, but here's the one thing I will say, you know, because we say not to do that. In some circumstances, when you get to a certain point, I think having a release date helps people get things done in time. In some certain circumstances. And why I would say that is since, you know, where we are at Small Town Poets now, it's not our job anymore to make music. But we still put as much thought and effort and expense into it as if it was, but it's easy to let life get in the way and just keep going, oh, I'll get to those next week. So we got to a certain point and where we knew, okay, we've got this stuff wrapping up on this date and we'll move forward. So
cool. What studio did you work out of?
You know what? I forget the name.
It was so magical. You forgot.
I could give you an explanation of where it was here in Portland, and you'd probably, it might have been there. It's kind of in the Broadway area. Well, these two guys used to share the space, and one of the guys moved on, and he took the name with him. So I honestly don't know what the name of the studio is. It was a room with gear with no windows, you know.
Exactly what you need, right?
Yeah, exactly what you need to make music. So I'm feeling good. I can move out of stressing about getting guitar parts done, and just move into planning for the release and whatnot. So that's where I'm at. I'm feeling good.
I saw pictures. You were using your Les Paul, right?
Yeah, I've got a new green Les Paul. I'm liking my favorite color's green, if anyone was curious. Green goes well with redheads, so you can't go wrong with green.
Speaking of green and red, are you doing anything for your Christmas music to...
Yeah, I mean, that's part of what, you know, to not get too much into the release plan I've kind of put together. But when we got to this point pushing into late fall where we were finishing up, I told the guys, look, here's the best way for us to tackle this. It's one, release a couple singles before Thanksgiving, which we've got in the works. I've got a live track that I'm queuing up to go live. And then we've got a new song that's being mixed this week that will be up in time. And then we should take the holiday season and let our Christmas albums win the day and promote the heck out of those, because you can't after December 25th. And then use the momentum from Christmas to start the build-up to the final release of the album in February. So that's our plan. In years past, you know, since our last couple major releases were Christmas records, we've seen a lot of traction, and then after Christmas, everything just dies, and we haven't had anything to come back with. So now we do. So hopefully we can build off that momentum that those records bring every Christmas and capitalize on it to, you know, advance the release.
Well, you might be happy or horrified to know that I just got a notification on my phone that Pandora Christmas Radio is live as of today.
Oh, Christmas is everywhere. I posted on Twitter, are we allowed to celebrate Thanksgiving anymore? Just, you know, because November 1st, everything, all the ads, everything went to Christmas. Apparently Black Friday means November now, because all these companies are saying, you know, get a sneak peek look at our Black Friday offers. And I'm like, what does this even mean anymore? But I will say, to wrap up this section, if you are going to release a Christmas album and don't have one coming out this year, 2018 is your year. And I will tell you why. It is the earliest that Thanksgiving can possibly be, because Thanksgiving's the fourth Thursday of every November. And so it is the earliest it can possibly be. And I know there's a lot of listeners who aren't in the U.S. and Thanksgiving is a U.S. holiday, but I also know that a lot of people kind of just key off of the promotion cycles that happen in the U.S. Around the holidays. But it's the earliest it can possibly be, so you have the largest window from Thanksgiving to Christmas to promote Christmas music. So 2018, if you've been thinking about doing a Christmas album, it's your year. What you don't want to do is what we did when we released our second Christmas album, which was in 2014, I believe, and it was the shortest window between Thanksgiving Day and Christmas Day, and it was like a literal 4 weeks, where next year you will have like 5.5 weeks, maybe even closer to almost 6 weeks to promote it. So something to consider. Start planning ahead. Their Christmas albums and holiday albums are great because they're fresh every year, and they kind of get this built-in momentum every year that is really helpful.
And this is a fact that only a true Christmas junkie would actually ever even realize a year in advance.
That's right.
Either a Christmas junkie or someone who is in charge of marketing.
That's right. Or someone who released an album on the worst possible year and was very frustrated. That year, right, was like, how on earth did we only, I mean, it's already Christmas and everything's like, it really made it tough because we released the album like the Tuesday before Thanksgiving, because release dates were still Tuesday that time. And it was like it was over in a flash, and it made it really hard for promoting songs for radio, for getting press. It really made it challenging. So I had to do a lot of reflection. What happened? And I realized, oh, we did it in the wrong year. But the bands don't plan for that. But I'm telling you, next year's the year. It's your year. You got Christmas season is long, and you will have a long time to promote. All right, we've got a lot of great stuff to get into with today's episode. Our discussion topic for today is three things that will hurt you on Spotify. And these are some pretty important things. We've been talking a lot about the great things in a streaming world and what streaming, how it's changed the industry and why artists should be paying attention and engaging in a streaming economy. But there are also some things that can and will hurt you if you don't do things properly. So we'll be getting into that. We'll be getting into that after the news, which we have coming up. And then at the end of the show, we've got a lot of great listener emails and calls. And so we're just going to have a supersized episode. So yeah, just hang in there. It's going to be a lot of good content. We had so many great questions and calls that I wanted to get into them all. So with that, let's get into some news.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
Music.
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 News.
It's a playlist world, so this announcement by Pandora is no surprise. From the Pandora blog, Tune in and listen up, Pandora listeners. We've added a ton of fresh music for your grooving pleasure, with many more coming soon. We have launched featured playlists to help you find the perfect jam to set the mood for any moment. Keep up with trending artists and discover new music with over 250 playlists that are handpicked and refreshed by our wickedly expert curators. But wait, there's more. A bunch of featured playlists also have a twinning radio station, so you can enjoy the awesomeness whether you're on free Pandora, Plus, or Premium. Head on over to your browse module to check out featured playlists. We've also made personalized recommendations based on your listening history. You're welcome. So, new playlists over at Pandora. And some Spotify news. Spotify diversity is up 40%. Spotify says it's experiencing an explosion in listening diversity on its service, by which it means the number of artists the average listener streams in a week. Since 2014, the average number of artists each listener streams per week has increased 37%, from just under 30 to about 41 artists per week so far in 2017. And the biggest increase happened in the past year, wrote the company's Insight team in a blog post. The majority of this effect is coming from our personalized and editorial playlist and discovery tools. Spotify also says that average weekly listening hours per user have grown by 25% since 2014. Although sadly, without providing figures on how many hours that is, it's clear more listeners are hearing more music on Spotify and they're streaming a wider variety of music, claimed the post. In other words, the pie is getting bigger and there are more slices going around. And that's the news. I just had those two articles. I thought they were timely with the discussion we're going to have today. Pandora adding playlists. It's clear that music platforms are going to be jumping into the playlist world.
Well, and Pandora has been planning this for a year at least, because I remember when they launched Premium, or when they first announced Premium, this playlist thing was sort of a promised aspect of it. So it's cool that they're...
yeah,
making something of it.
And I'll link to the Spotify article to their blog. It was pretty extensive. There was a lot of data. It was all very encouraging, but I think it points to a lot of what we've been talking about on this podcast, especially our Spotify Myths Debunked episode, where we talked about the idea that there are more people listening to more music in a streaming world than in a buying economy. And I think the data that is coming out of Spotify is proof of that, that the number of artists people are listening to is growing, and a lot of the tools that these platforms are providing are driving that experience. And I think, we're going to need to see folks like Apple Music get on the stick. I know they're working on some things, but they've been pretty protective and controlling of playlists. But I think user-generated playlists and a lot of these algorithms that are driving discovery are actually making a difference.
Yeah, and I know Discover Weekly has been out for more than a year, but it feels like in the last year, you know, friends and family members of mine, like, they're more keyed into it. You know, it's more part of their life. Like, my wife is even every single week making a point of listening to her entire Discover Weekly playlist. And so that's obviously a big part of the widening spectrum of things being listened to.
Indeed. Yeah. So I'll link to that article. It's worth checking out and digging in a little bit to the data. If you're still a Spotify skeptic and don't think that it helps, this might, and you're a data person, if you're a data person, this might help you wrap your head around how it could possibly be helping artists instead of hurting them.
That being said, I did have a conversation yesterday with a musician friend of mine who, you know, he's like me, old and jaded. Older and jaded. And he had some good points about, I would say some good negative points about some of this Spotify, the way in which music trends on Spotify. But maybe that's a different discussion.
Maybe so. I will say, I know we're pretty strong on Spotify on the podcast. That doesn't mean we think it's perfect. And that doesn't mean that we don't think there's work to do to, you know, make sure that artists are paid the most they should be for their music, and this streaming world is new and people are still figuring out what is a stream truly worth. But with Chris and I working at CD Baby and talking to so many artists, we've just seen so many people just have wrong views of what are happening on the, how these platforms are being used to their advantage and sort of discrediting. And what's possible and kind of discrediting the success artists are having as anomalies. And it's just, we're seeing it over and over again, day by day. Lots of artists emerging and seeing success and building a fan base and growing their audience because these platforms are driving the music further than it was in just a download world or a CD world. So that's what we're trying to highlight. And I know sometimes we get accused of being too pro-streaming and maybe more pro-streaming than pro-artists, but we're just trying to get people to stop being so freaked out by it and consider the strategic ways these things are actually helping them.
Yeah, and I saw today that Pink did a instead of doing like a radio tour of going from station to station or whatever, she went from Spotify office to Spotify office and Apple Music office. She's visiting the streaming headquarters.
Yep.
As a suggestion that streaming really is overpowering radio in importance in terms of breaking artists.
Yes. Interesting. And I am interested in the things that your friend said, but we'll save that for
different discussion.
So, because we are going to talk about three things that will hurt you on Spotify. So let's start that discussion right now. So, Chris, you wrote an article. Tell me about the background of the article, and then we'll go through point by point, because I know that there was some inspiration for the article.
Yes. Yeah, so at a recent music conference, there was a panel discussion called Developing New Artists in the Digital Age. And among the panelists was Brian Johnson, who is, high up at Spotify UK. And they kind of just discussed things that they thought artists were doing wrong or opportunities that were being missed because artists are focusing on the wrong things in streaming in general, but also sort of particular to Spotify. I kind of summarized those points. I could go through them if you like.
Let's just start with point number one and we'll go through point by point.
Yeah, so a lot of the panelists thought that the first mistake people make is they worry about, quote, vanity metrics. And what they mean by that is, you know, any sort of data point or statistic that you think makes you look really cool and important as an artist. So the obvious one for Spotify would be your play count. But similar to YouTube, basically the most important thing on YouTube is how long a viewer, your average viewer watches your video, not how many total views you have. If you have 1 million views of your video, but everyone bounced after 30 seconds, that looks, a lot worse than if you only had 100,000 views and everyone watched almost the whole video. So the same thing is true with Spotify. You could have 1 million plays, but if no one's adding those songs to their own playlists or, sharing them on Facebook with friends or anything, it's not that they're meaningless. They still drive revenue, but it's not really doing anything in terms of true fan engagement for you. So, So Spotify pays closer attention to, what would you call it? Kind of an engagement to play count ratio. So if you have a modest fan base, that's fine. Just try to get your modest fan base to engage with the music.
Yes. And in this crazy world we're now living in, Chris, there are two things that I still know to be true. One, the sun will rise in the east and set in the west. And two, if you show artist metrics against an artist account, they will do their darndest to gain those metrics.
Always have, always will.
Those two things in life I know to be true. From the early MySpace days to... it's funny because I remember back in the MySpace days, all these services popped up that could get you plays on your MySpace page. And so artists were calling us all the time. We're figuring out ways to game the system because they thought it was so important. Someone put a metric next to my name. It needs to be big. we've come to a point in the way these platforms work and social media that fakes are so easy to spot because it's not one metric. You can't have a gazillion streams on one particular song and zero on everything else, or you know, there's just things that don't add up, and it's easy to spot a fake.
Well, yeah, and I mean, this is a practice that's decades and decades old. You know, record labels used to ship massive units that they knew would never sell to stores so they could chart and then, you know, take a bunch of returns. And I mean, that was worth one thing in terms of getting your name on the charts. But this, like, Spotify knows that, yeah, exactly. They know if you have a million streams, but no one added it to a playlist, that those are probably fake streams or just not.
Or if you have no artist followers or, yeah.
Right. Or maybe not fake entirely, but, you know, there's sort of a quality of engagement thing that's going on. And Spotify knows. They're looking at every different kind of data, you know, set that they can, and putting it all together to form a picture of what they should be getting behind. So, yeah. So yeah. There's two cautionary tales about this. One is that I have friends who I have seen when I'm on Spotify listening to stuff, I'll see them listening to their own band, like on repeat, you know, hours at a time. And I'm like,
like the music.
maybe they have a set coming up and they forgot all their own material, so they're brushing up. I don't know. But
actually, I've started using Spotify to practice.
Oh, really? Well, you might as well. I guess you're getting paid for it. But no, I'm not talking about occasionally listening to your own music. Like every time I'm on there listening, I look over and the user activity of my friends, and it's constant. Like I'm just like, first of all, it looks lame. You're like, we can see you trying to game the system here. And two, just make your listening, what's it called? Your listening habits private. If you're going to do that, like, don't broadcast it to the world. And then the second thing is that, you know, people pay services for fake likes. So I'm sure we can get into that one.
Yes. This conversation is very timely because just today, when we were recording this podcast, Ari Herstam posted an article on Digital Music News about an issue that we've been trying to help him through, because he's got an album distributed through CD Baby, and he found a service that says they will get you, I think it was like 50,000 to 150,000 plays on Spotify, something like that. I don't have the exact details in front of me, but it was a number like that. Whatever those people do in order to get those plays triggered fraud alert on Spotify's end, and they pulled the album for fraudulent activity. So you should never, ever, ever, and I mean never, someone's still going to do it at this point, and I'm telling them not to, pay to have somebody, a service, promise guaranteed plays on Spotify or any of these services that are paying out royalties for plays, because they will shut it down. And they will just pull the album.
And to clarify, you're talking about a different kind of service than streaming playlist promotions. That's a more legitimate way to spend your money, not guaranteeing results, but at least that's an investment that's legal and...
Yes. Yes. Someone like Charles, who's been on the podcast, has a reputable company that they actually know playlist curators, just like radio promoters know radio programmers. And so it's dealing through that relationship. That is 100% legit. Those kind of services are real. But you should never, ever, ever pay for a service that says they are guaranteeing you plays. My assumption of what's happening based on, because like I said, this just happened. We've been helping Ari trying to get his album back up because unfortunately for Ari, this service came highly recommended from a contact of his that works for basically a management company that manages major label artists. So there was some good reason why he thought, you know, this would be legitimate. It came highly recommended from some trusted sources. But what these companies do, they pretty much just have some system set up, and it goes to like probably a click farm, which is, you know, if you watch the show Silicon Valley, there's a whole couple episodes where they basically have fake users in Bangladesh logging in to game their metrics. So it's that kind of thing where there's people playing and then, but they're not really fans. My assumption is that they're probably playing the song only 35 seconds and then stopping and doing it again to try and juice the play count, play it enough so it counts, and then move on. And those are probably some of the things that Spotify is looking at as fraudulent activity.
Right. And on top of that, as we said, Spotify is looking at all different kinds of data. So as they're seeing this play count go up, they're also seeing that all those people don't like the song. They're skipping out after 30 seconds. It means the song's not good. So why would they serve it to anyone organically?
Yeah, and they're not following the artist. They're not adding it to playlists. And it's not like all your fans are going to do that. But it's when you start looking at data and you see a huge spike of 100,000 plays on a song and none of these other activities are happening, it's clear something's up. They don't want to pay royalties on fraudulent activity. They don't want people gaming the system. That's not good for anybody. So they shut that down and they'll pull your music down. The company, you know, that was used is called Streamify, and it looks legit. But there's some things in the FAQ that are did give away. You know, it says that they send out the music to a list of DJs and record producers and all that stuff. Now, let's think about it, people. When in the history of the music industry have there been a giant list of DJs, record producers, industry professionals just sitting around listening to random bands all day long? It just doesn't happen. But there's some other things that tip you off that it's fake. And when they say the play counts will be delivered within 24 hours. So then you say, okay, when in the history of the music business does a list of DJs, record producers get back to listening to everything that fast?
No, but this company, they've really got it locked in. They're the ones that have it figured out.
So clearly they are, you know, they may be sending it to a list of DJs and record producers in order to justify that statement on their website, but that's not where the plays are coming from. So do not use those services. It will get your album pulled down. We've been going back and forth with Spotify to plead Ari's case, and it's still to be determined whether they'll put the album back up. So basically, if they don't, he'll have to redistribute it. He'll lose all the play counts on that album, and, you know, tough lesson learned. So
yeah, and I mentioned friends of mine who have been listening to their own music. You can also get your music pulled off of Spotify for that, even if you're, you know, sort of quote unquote legitimately listening to your music on repeat. There's a listener of this podcast who I met at our recent conference who had been doing that a while back, and his music got pulled from Spotify, and it was a big ordeal, like you said, to get it back. I think, like you said, he lost his play count, any reviews or whatever that might have been associated with it on, you know, whatever. Yeah, so just real quick before we move on to the next point, I'm thinking we should also tell people, okay, if you're not focused on, quote, vanity metrics, what should you be doing? So a few things. Do whatever you can to get your fans to follow you on Spotify. Your follower count, as we'll talk about in the next point, has a big thing, a big impact on how many algorithmic playlists your music ends up on. So get your fans to follow you. Two, if you're putting out a song, don't just wait for it to drop and then, you know, share the link and say, hey, go listen to my music. Instead, use a pre-save function, get people to save it to their song queue ahead of time, which again, instructs Spotify's algorithm to think it's an important release. And three, I had a third thing in mind. It's slipping my mind now. Followers. Oh, Evan, just the simple requesting that your fans add your songs to their playlists. That can have a huge impact.
Yeah, and, you know, people might be saying, hey, but I tried this on YouTube and I didn't get in trouble, or I tried this on SoundCloud, because there are services that do those things for those platforms as well. The hammer's going to fall harder when you're doing something that's going to incur royalties. So, like, SoundCloud doesn't pay independent artists royalties for streams. So sure, you can spend money and juice your account there. It's still going to be obvious it's fake. But and when SoundCloud sees it, they may shut it down. They may not. I'm not sure. I'm not as familiar with their policies there. And, you know, depending on what the metric is on YouTube, I know that YouTube does give strikes to channels. They might give you a hand slap and before they shut your channel down, depending on what you're doing. So there are people that will, you know, boost your subscriber count artificially. All the people that care about those numbers can spot fake, so it's just not worth it. But if, you know, if your SoundCloud account came down, you know, you can just sign up a new one. But when you're blocked on Spotify, one of the main platforms people are listening to music on, that really sucks.
Yeah. So the second point that these panelists made was that artists are paying way too much attention to getting their music onto curated playlists. So, you know, we on this podcast and on the blog, we've talked a lot about that. Playlists, you know, getting your song on a hot playlist can have a huge impact, you know, get you new fans, drive a lot of streams. That's great, obviously. But it's also kind of the, you know, this crowning achievement. So everyone's trying to do it. Those people are hard to reach. They're hard to impress. And meanwhile, everyone's putting their energy into that. When really, as this guy Brian Johnson, who works at Spotify, says, the algorithmic playlists are actually driving significantly more streams than the curated editorial playlists. So what you really want to focus on is doing whatever you can to make sure your music ends up on the release radar playlist whenever you put out new music, and to get it onto Discover Weekly, those sorts of things. By doing the things we mentioned in the last point, you know, do whatever you can to boost your following, because those are the people who are going to be notified by Spotify through those playlists. And also, I'm not sure what their criteria is for sending out the email notification, but, you know, that's another option Spotify has to promote something they think is worthwhile.
You know what's creepy about that email notification you mentioned?
What?
Last Friday, I was doing a press interview for CD Baby, and they asked me, what bands have you found, discovered at CD Baby that you really dig? And I said a band's name that I had not mentioned in my office or listened to on Spotify in months, months and months and months. And 2 seconds later, I got a release radar email from Spotify for that very
Big Brother
band.
Is watching and listening. They know.
It was like, oh, dang, he just said that band. They got a new album. Bing, there you go. It was crazy. I didn't tell the guy on the phone because it would have been a distraction from where the conversation was going. But I was just like, oh, my goodness. And it was a band called This Will Destroy You. It's that instrumental post-rock stuff that I love, and I mentioned that I came across them at CD Baby and have loved them ever since. And literally the second after that came out of my mouth, because I had my email open, that email came through.
Very
weird.
And then so it was a release radar announcement, and they had how old was their release at that point? It had come out that week.
I think it was a Friday, so I think it was new that day.
Okay, yeah. So yeah, I'm not exactly sure what their criteria is for putting stuff into that email, but I mean, I know in general that it's better if you're at a kind of lower level in your career. Like, it's about getting the fans you have to do stuff for your music on Spotify, like aiming for the pie in the sky and hoping your song's going to get on My Favorite Coffee House or whatever. Like, sure, it could happen, but like, it's way more likely to happen once you focus on these things that will surface your music in the algorithmic playlists. And if it does well there, it goes into more and more people's algorithmic playlists. And then that's kind of the snowball effect you're hoping for, rather than just, you know, again, shooting at the target in the sky.
Yeah, because what I've heard about the release radar playlist is that when people who follow your music, so say most, you know, say you have 1,000 fans and they're all following you on Spotify, when your new album comes out, they will get notified, whether it's just like in that playlist, or maybe you're lucky enough that it triggers an email, most likely not, but you never know. What I've read about it says that it also looks for people that like similar music to feature in their release radar as well. So, you know, they want that release radar playlist to be a consistent size each week. If the average person, I'm just making up numbers here just for the heck of it, if the average person followed 50 artists on Spotify, well, chances are there's not going to be enough new music released every week by those artists to fill a release radar playlist. So they're going to start matching tastes with other people, and they're really trying to get people listening to more music. I actually copied a tweet. I saw somebody, you know, Twitter post saying, dang, we could tell we got added to the Discover Weekly instantly because our play count started shooting through the roof, you know. And, you know, because they kind of saw their play count going up like crazy and realized, oh, we were put in the Discover Weekly for a lot of people. So there's those things are really working. And it's like, if you properly juice the algorithm in the correct manner, not by buying plays, but by getting your fans to follow you, getting your fans to save your music to their library, and getting them to add it to playlists and share it, the chances of that happening will go up significantly.
So the third point is one we've talked about a lot on this podcast, and is that most artists aren't releasing enough music to really take advantage of fans on Spotify. You know, if you want to do well on that platform, you need to release music more frequently, even if it means you're releasing less music more frequently. You know, it doesn't have to be an album every month. It could be a single or a single every other month, and eventually you put out the album or the EP or whatever. But the guy from Spotify UK on this panel said, we are dealing in attention economics, which I thought was an interesting way of saying it. But, you know, you got to keep people baited in a way. And if you disappear for 2 or 3 years, you're going to lose them. Like, the world has changed so much since 10 or 20 years ago when, you know, we were happy to wait for that. And the release was a big deal after all this anticipation. Like, so, I mean, basically what artists should be thinking about doing is when they're working on bigger recording projects, EPs or albums, you got to have some kind of strategy for either releasing a number of singles up to that release, or just stockpiling kind of extra material, bonus material, or whatever, demos, tracks that you know don't fit on the album but you still like, you know, anything. You've got to have this extra stuff set aside to kind of tide people over.
Yeah, and this is where, you know, I personally struggle, but Chris, you have like 20 albums in the can already, so you could do this till, you know, you retire.
I just have to give up on the notion of actually ever putting out an album, and I can put out a single every month.
I still think albums are important, and we've had our album versus single debate episode, and a lot of our thoughts are there if you want to go back and listen to that. But I think that these platforms and what he's saying about, you know, attention economics are true. And so it needs to shift your strategy some, in that you need to be releasing as much as you possibly can. And I don't think that means just throw things out haphazardly, but at least start with the idea of, you know, getting a couple singles out, like what we're trying to do before an album release, is going to help generate some activity. And activity can help indicate things are happening and help snowball for when an actual release happens. But it's also a matter of changing the mindset about what is something that's releasable. You know, this is where covers come in. You know, cover songs. There's lots of great covers that you could be doing that enhances the experience of you as a band, that fills those gaps. Or just thinking, like, you know, we mentioned holiday albums, just the idea that you should be creating as much music as possible. And the reason I still like the album experience, because I think it helps fans get into the music in a way that's more digestible and understanding of maybe where you're at as a musician, because as you grow and change, you know, your sound might shift and change. And sometimes that context really helps the experience of you as an artist. But you can't do that album and then for the next 5 years not release anything. It's got to be something that's more planned, and it takes changing how we've sort of been taught we're supposed to work as artists.
Yeah, well, so on this topic of frequency of release, there's two somewhat contradictory bits of advice to consider. You know, one is no more correct than the other, but they might inform how you sort of strategize this. And one is, in this panel, they said, you know, you always have to be a few tracks ahead of yourself. And I think a lot of times, if we know it's just going to be a single, we finish it, we're excited, we want to put it out. Like, we don't want to sit on something and stockpile a bunch of, you know, songs to release down the line. You know, we're so excited about just getting stuff out. So that lesson would be patient. You know, be patient. If you put out an EP and you have other four tracks waiting, wait until the EP is kind of dying down, and then release those tracks one at a time. The contradictory bit of advice is this Brian Johnson guy from Spotify said, gone are the days when you just spend 6 or 8 weeks prepping a single and then dropping it to see how it goes. Now you can just drop the track and then work it, because that's the track's available. People want it. So it's sort of like, you know, don't think you need to be putting all this effort into ramping up this campaign with all this promotion beforehand. Like, you know, it's fine to just finish something and just put it out, and then, you know, then put your promotion muscle behind it once it's out. Well, those two things are somewhat at odds, but I think they're both viable approaches.
They may not be at odds too much. I mean, I think what he's saying is that there's no reason why you have to hold on to a track if it's like, say, if it's done. In the world of radio, it was like, yes, you had to start planning for this future date when you were going to ask all the radio programmers to add your music, and you know, it, you needed this them to all be synced up in order to have maximum effect, impact and all that. And so it took a lot of pre-work before the fans were getting the music. Where now, if no one knows the song's on Spotify, it's just sitting there. But I mean, it's like, so if you put it out and you start seeing how people react to it, then you can start building a strategy around it. And we're kind of, the days of release dates being important are gone. It's just music, you know? Good music is good music. That's one of the things I love about where we're at in a playlist and streaming world is that, you know, people will hear music and they go, I love this band. And they might find out, oh, it's 10 years old. Who cares? Where in the past, an album being 10 years old might restrict it from a lot of opportunities. But those days are gone. So I think that might be kind of the spirit of what he's saying. The other thing that I really like is that currently Spotify features albums over everything else. And at first you might think, well, that's kind of weird. My latest single is sort of not of given as much prominence as my most recent album. The reason I like this is because then it encourages you to release stuff that is more like B-side material, live tracks, just trying stuff. So it doesn't like take over your Spotify profile where someone lands there and they see a bunch of seemingly random tracks. The complete albums are still prominent. And you have the opportunity to feature a track at the top. So you can always feature your latest single.
Yeah, you know, that's a great point. Like about a year ago, before the last election, I recorded a really, really crappy recording of a song. I think, you know, I obviously think the song is good, but I recorded on this Blue Snowball mic into GarageBand. Like, it doesn't sound good, but I needed it to get out there before the election happened. It didn't work. My intention didn't work. But, you know, because of the sound, the recording quality of it, it's not something I would want to, like you say, be at the top of my feed on Spotify. I'm glad that's sort of now at the bottom, but it's a little experiment that will live there. Another thing I was thinking of, as you release more and more music, things that Show.co offers, like the pre-save, and also just the, I forget what it's called, but you know, you can basically share your music on Spotify, but before someone gets to it, they follow you or they leave an email. Like, any of those types of campaigns are great. And the more you release, the more you have the opportunity to kind of hone your messaging with those types of campaigns. Like on my pre-save campaign I did over the last month, I, you know, ended up thinking my message was pretty boring. It was, you know, the equivalent of, hey, I've got a new song out, which is like what we tell people not to say. Like, who gives a shit? But, you know, I think it's me, so my followers will want to, you know, they'll care. But rather than doing something like your, you know, hey, check out the song that got us kicked off stage, or, you know, we saw a couple days ago a guy using Show.co who said, you know, hear the song that made me move 500 miles away from my home. Like, you know, there's a hook there. So I think the more music you release, the better you'll get at sort of, you know, getting into that mindset of promoting releases to your fans and making things feel more enticing.
Well, and as I always say, you have to look at it from their perspective. How can you add some value to your listeners and your fans? A lot of times we approach promotion by like, look at me, I did this. Don't you want to look at me and listen to what I did? And instead of going, you know, saying something intriguing or saying something that captures their attention in a way that makes them want to hear the music. So I think those that tool, Show.co, is really useful in being able to try those things. And, you know, the great thing about using tools like that is that failure is fine as long as you learn from it. Running a campaign that didn't work, just learn from it and adjust and keep trying. And those tools make it easy to do that. And it also makes it fun because then you start thinking, what else can I do? What other content can I create that will intrigue people or bring them into the story of who I am? And ultimately make them want to click a button to follow me on Spotify so they can have access to it.
Right. And you said this, but I think the fact that the campaigns on Show.co look great and they're really, really easy to build makes it that much more motivating and inspiring to get creative. So, you know, on my next single, I'm going to come up with a really creative hook.
All right. I'll be looking for it.
All right.
To round this last point out in this section of the podcast, point number three being that you're not releasing enough music. I think ultimately all artists in this day and age suffer from this. I won't say all. A lot of us do, because some people just crank it out right and left. And you're like, holy cow, how do you do that? But there's so much distractions, going back to point number one, worrying about vanity metrics and follower counts, social impact, all this stuff, you know, that I think can be very helpful and help guide strategy, help us reach fans. But a lot of times it can be a distraction from just writing and recording music and getting better as an artist. I will say, I say it all the time, I'll say it again. One of the key things I see from the artists in our catalog that make very nice full-time living, a full-time living from their music. One of the key things I see that's pretty common across all those artists is they're building a large catalog of music. And fans and popular songs build more fans and popular songs. The bigger your catalog gets, the more your fans can listen and stream, the more they get excited about it, the more they tell other people, they share it, the more they want to see you, the more they're along for the ride. And so to me, it's like, if you're not focusing on writing and recording new music and you got all your time spent on other things, you need to get the priorities straight and start there. Start writing and recording and releasing music, because everything else is just empty marketing campaigns if there's not a continuation of building fans for your music.
And building the story, which we've talked about quite a bit.
Exactly. Well, if you've got comments or feedback, or just want to weigh in on something related to the topic at hand, you can do so. You can call our listener line at 360-524-2209, or you can email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com, or you can leave a comment on the show notes at the podcast website. And don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes or whatever podcatching device you use. I know we get a lot of new people listening to the podcast every week, and a lot of folks are still listening right from the website. The easiest way to keep up with the podcast is to just subscribe in a podcatching app on your mobile device. I love an app called Overcast. I recommend it. There's a free version and a paid version. The free version works just fine, and I never miss a podcast because I'm a podcast junkie. So if you haven't subscribed, do that. That would be great. And speaking of listener feedback, we have a lot of great questions. And where should we start? Do you want to start with some calls or some emails? What do you want to do, Chris?
Can we alternate?
Sure, we can alternate.
Well, let's start with whatever there's more of.
We're going to start with a call because, yes, there's four calls and three emails, and they're all good. So please stick with us. Here we go.
Hey, guys. My name is Mike Almaraz, and I have an indie folk pop soul kind of band in Tucson, Arizona called Infinite Souls. We're on Facebook and Instagram at We Are Infinite Souls and online at weareinfinitesouls.com, thanks to your cross-platform branding tips. My question is about time management. I have a tendency of overanalyzing and overthinking things, and while that can be helpful in certain areas, it can also make small tasks far more time-consuming than they need to be. So, especially as a currently bivocational artist, where should I be spending my time? And which areas should I let myself get engrossed in the details? And where should I just settle for good enough? Also, do you schedule things like social media posts, live streams, website updates, et cetera? Or do you just do them at whim? Thanks so much, guys. I love the podcast. You're an amazing resource.
All right. Thanks for the call, Mike. What do you think, Chris?
Well, so is he asking about time management in general across all the areas that you have to manage?
I think so. I think that's what he's talking about.
I think I would lean on what you said about the last point of our Spotify discussion, which is don't skimp on writing and recording and making sure your music's as good as it can be, obviously. Don't stop till you're satisfied there. And maybe the same goes for your live show and making sure you're putting on, you know, good events. I would say beyond that, good enough is probably okay for most of it. Like, you know, if you're going to make a music video, like instead of making 12 music videos for every song on your album, like do one or two and put as much as you can into it to make those great. But I don't know. I don't feel like stressing over things like social media is all that worthwhile, especially because you do it so often. Like, you know, like it's Facebook, something you do twice a day or whatever. Like if you screw something up, it's not a big deal. Like, so yeah, not sure if that's helpful, but that'd be my take on it.
I'd agree. It's hard to really comment with too much detail because not knowing what type of music Mike does and his main focus, if he's touring at all or whatnot. But anyway, I would say that, yeah, sort of the same vein what you're saying is if you don't find yourself gravitating towards certain platforms naturally, then don't labor over trying to make something happen. You know, I'll talk to artists all the time. They're like, I feel like I have to be on all these platforms all day long. I hate Facebook. I don't understand Twitter. I like Instagram. I'm like, great. Just have fun on Instagram. Build your story there. It's a great promotion tool. And stop worrying about all this other stuff that is probably distracting you from the things that you should be doing anyway. So that's some basic advice around that. As far as scheduling posts, I actually do schedule some when I know we're going to be having activity. Some people will say you should never do that. Typically, what they're talking about when that happens is, you know, what I see here at CD Baby every day. There's artists that have the same post scheduled 5 times a day and have for years. And I'm not exaggerating. There's actually one of our blog articles that someone has scheduled to be posted like 3 or 4 times a day. And it's been that way for going on probably 3 years at this point.
Oh, you need to tell me which article it is.
It's Twitter versus Facebook. It's an old article, and it's I see it every day. Like every day when I come into work and I open up TweetDeck and see what people are saying about CD Baby, I see that article reposted. So that's what you should not do. What people that are anti-scheduling are typically they're just pointing to the fact that stuff doesn't do anything for you, especially if someone comments on it and it's like. You ghost them. You're not even there. You don't respond. You don't engage with them. So typically what I'll do is when I know that we have new music or we're playing some shows, that I'll schedule some posts around that activity, knowing I'm going to be on Twitter a lot and those platforms a lot, but that I won't have the time to be writing posts and responding to posts and actually being a musician that plays in a band at the same time and not a marketing person. So I typically schedule some stuff when I know I'm going to be active and that I will engage with people, but just won't need to worry about writing stuff.
Yeah. Oh, and the other obvious good thing about scheduling is that, you know, if the only time you have to write your email newsletter is Tuesday night, but you know that the biggest open rate you get is on Thursday afternoon, then write it on Tuesday and schedule it for Thursday. But I tend to like, in terms of social stuff, I tend to like just doing it off the cuff because then I know I'm around to start responding and liking and commenting back if anything happens like that, you know? So I'm also just not much of a planner. So that's.
Yeah, I wouldn't recommend, you know, scheduling out 100 tweets and then going on vacation for 2 weeks because. People will probably respond or they'll get the idea that you're not around and it's just that it just gets perceived as spam. So that's what you want to avoid. But I think there can be ways it's done correctly. The other thing that scheduling I think can be important is we tend to think about the world from where we sit. And, you know, even though I'm on Pacific time in Portland, Oregon, the rest of the world is not on Pacific time in Portland, Oregon. And so some of your fans may be in Europe and you're always tweeting when it's in the middle of the night for them. Well, scheduling some tweets during the day for them might be a good idea because otherwise they may never see anything. So that's something to consider as well. If your fans are in a drastically different time zone than you, that's how you can use it to enhance what you're doing. All right. Thanks for the call, Mike. We're going to move on to an email. Hey, Kevin and Chris, first off, thank you for doing this. I know it's your job, but you do it well. The podcast is informative, entertaining, and inspiring. Not much more to ask for. If it was up to me, there could even be bonus episodes in between the big ones with you guys just talking about your latest experiences with your own music at length. Now for my question. I'm going to put out a new album next year with my songwriter project, Trailhead, and I've been wondering, like many do, does it even make sense to shop around for a label? For my last album, I went with a label as it covered the manufacturing costs of my CDs. In return, I had to buy a minimum of CDs from them, which cost me as much as I would have paid for manufacturing myself, only I ended up with fewer CDs this way. So why did I do that, knowing the conditions beforehand? I had kind of hoped that the label would put an effort into selling enough CDs on their end for the deal to make sense. It turned out they put zero effort into it. They got their manufacturing costs covered, and that was that. An experiment which I will not repeat. I'm in sort of a similar situation like Chris, a touring singer-songwriter who puts out albums on a semi-regular basis. I'd like to know from you guys, what would a realistically ideal label record deal look like for you? I'm probably going to self-release my new album, but I'm interested anyway. Thanks so much. Keep up the outstanding work. And that was from Tobias.
Hey, Tobias. I follow his Trailhead project on Facebook.
Oh, how nice. You guys are Facebook buddies.
Yeah, we're buddies. So the question is, what would an ideal label relationship look like?
Yes.
Is that, well, I can just think about kind of realistic indie label deals that are kind of, you know, in realistic at my level, which is always kind of like the 50-50 split where the label obviously is shouldering the budget and the burden of PR and, you know, any number of other things that are needed. Sometimes the artist has shouldered the recording costs. But yeah, where they're fully invested in moving physical product for sure.
Well, they're invested in promoting some way for sure. And I would also add that there is a clause that you are getting your rights back or you get to keep your rights. There are some labels that are doing deals where it's just like one-offs and the artist maintains their rights, but the label gets to participate for a period of time in the revenues from the project. So there's things like that that are out there. I think the experience you had is a pitfall that many artists fall into. In fact, I know a label that built a massive amount of revenue and ended up being bought by one of the majors by doing exactly what you outlined here. So basically what they did is they would offer just about any band that seemed to have any bit of talent a deal, with air quotes, a deal. And basically it'd be what they would pay for the CD manufacturing, and the artist was required to buy back so many copies, just like you outlined. And so the record company has their money, and if the artist goes out and fails, no big deal. But if they start having some success, then they start putting a little effort in and start using that way as kind of like letting things bubble to the top. So it's kind of a no-risk way for them to sort things. This particular label that I'm thinking of, that this was their whole strategy, within a couple years had over like 200 artists signed to their roster. So that's a good indicator that they're not going to put much effort into you. So if you see a label saying, hey, we'll cover your duplication cost, and they've got a large, large catalog, they're not going to put any effort into you. They're just trying to get you tied up in the event that something does go well with the release, and then they can cash in on it.
Yeah, one thing I'm just thinking of, I'm pretty sure Tobias is in Germany. Did he mention where he lives?
Does not mention it.
I think he's in Germany, and I don't know if this is true in Germany, but I know in some areas of Europe, there's this kind of, well, you need to be on a label attitude, and so what happens is there'll be co-ops and groups of friends that kind of form labels, which always seems a little bit, well, if you're getting something out of it, great, but also sometimes there's a bit of a vanity aspect to it, and I always think, well, like, if that's the case, why not just put it out yourself?
I've experienced that with my travels in Europe and talking to artists that a lot of them do come together as smaller collaborative groups of artists to have a label. And it just, it does seem like it's still something that people think is important. So
I know we've talked about this, I think, whereas, you know, American individualism and all that stuff. So like the total DIY thing makes sense here. And maybe the more collective effort, you know, in the cultural DNA makes more sense there. But I feel like that would be great if everyone that's involved in the co-op is actually doing some heavy lifting. But if it's like one, everything's falling on one person, then it's eventually going to peter out and be worthless anyways.
Yeah. Which in my experience in those conversations I've had, it's been like five bands from a similar town coming together, and the one guy that's actually internet savvy gets shouldered with all the the work, and they're really just using something like CD Baby and calling it, you know, this thing a label, which we do distribute labels, but as far as like a label really should be an organization that is actively advancing a catalog of music. If it's not actively advancing a catalog of music, all at this point it is in the state of the industry is a rights grab, because you can get your music out to the world without anybody getting in the way like a label. Well, thanks for the email, Tobias. All right, we've got a call. This is Francis.
Hey, Kevin and Chris. This is Francis Drost from Pennsylvania. I just wanted to let you know that I really enjoyed the DIY conference. It was the first time I could make it. Glad it was in Nashville. And it was just really great. All the keynote sessions, I got so much. But I just wanted to tell you, the Facebook Live, I came home and tried it. And I decided to set some goals. So first, through the tip jar, I was able to pay for my conference fee to go to the conference. And then I asked for $55 to copyright my Christmas project so we could start promoting it for syncing and licensing. And someone sent me a check in the mail for $55, said, we believe in your music, we want to see that happen. So now I can get that copyrighted. And now my next goal is to raise enough money to get my one of my CD projects reprinted, solo piano music. So I just wanted to let you know that that's just one of the takeaways I had. There were many, but that was a big one for me. And so love the podcast, love the conference. I'd just say maybe next year, maybe this happened, but I missed it. But I'd love to see a way for people who are within the same geographical state to connect, like everyone from Pennsylvania, everyone from Texas, whatever, just to have a chance to get together. So just a suggestion. Again, thanks. Love it. Keep it going. Talk to you later. Bye.
Thanks for the call, Frances. And her call was sort of a kick in the backside for me to have some serious plans and execute them pertaining to Facebook Live, coming up with some shows I'm doing with Small Town Poets and the release of this album, and just taking advantage of us being together and not even using that as a crutch, like, oh, we can't do Facebook Live because we're not together. Because there's lots of great things that you can do just by jumping on and start talking to your fans immediately. Because it's not just a matter of people, you know, congregating, oh, there's this live event, but Facebook actually starts featuring that content more heavily immediately when you do it. So it's worthwhile. And she's making money from the tip jar. And who couldn't use more money for their music projects?
And Rick Barker's talk, I found it pretty inspiring too. I went and got a Shure Lightning cable microphone to attach to my phone. And, you know, sometime in the next couple of weeks, I want to start trying it out. And yeah, I thought his talk was great. And it was the last episode of this podcast too, wasn't it?
Yep, the one right before this. You'll have to send me a link for what microphone you bought, because I think the tools are starting to emerge to make this stuff much easier. And I know Instagram just launched a new feature for its live feature where you can bring someone in and have a conversation with them. I was actually on the phone with Rick Barker the day they pushed that live, and he was showing it to me while I was on the call, and it looked pretty cool. So lots of great things happening, and it's cool to see that Frances was even able to pay for her conference ticket that way. I think that's a good way that artists should say, hey, get my fans to help send me to Nashville.
Yeah, totally. I love the idea about...
I think that's a great campaign.
And I love the idea about the regional meetups, because we do genre meetups. That's been a thing every year where, you know, everyone from folk and hip hop, whatever, they all get together and converse. But we should totally do regional. You know, I don't think we'd... I don't know if a state by state one, but maybe a Northwest, Southwest, Northeast, yeah. Midwest, whatever. Like, that might be cool.
Well, we definitely got more... We definitely got requests for more meetups, Francis. So we have planned to do more next year. So we will do that. We will do it because Francis asked on the podcast. And speaking of next conference, August 24th through 26th in Nashville, tickets will be on sale like within a week. So actually, technically, if you find the ticket page, they're already up for sale. Somebody's already started buying tickets. So you want to get in on that. All right, let's keep rolling because we've got more calls and emails. Here's another email. Hey, Kevin, love the podcast, of course. I wanted to know your advice on fans. My band in Provo, Utah has been around for 2 years, and every concert we play, we have to practically twist our friends' arms to get them to come to our concerts. Is there a secret to gaining authentic fans? Is there a secret that ensures we don't need to be dependent on our friends and family? Do we need to play gigs more consistently and all of a sudden we'll see more fans than friends? Anyway, I see other bands accomplishing that and I definitely see it's possible, but I can't quite figure out how they do it. Would love to know your take on that. Sincerely puzzled, Robert.
Hey, here's what they're doing. They're fooling everyone into thinking that their concerts are these really cool events where if they go, they're going to seem cool too. Even if they're terrible. Honestly, sometimes I go out and I'm like, wait, this band has this room full? What the hell? What are these idiots listening to? This is terrible. You've all been fooled. And then I'll go and I'll see another band that, you know, there'll be 10 people in the audience and they're great. And it's like, what is going on?
Yeah, I've experienced that same thing, especially here in Portland when Hello Morning was playing shows. And we sort of had some of these same struggles that Robert's talking about. Sometimes we'd have a good night. Other times it felt like, you know, we couldn't pay people to come. And it starts to feel very puzzling. So the first thing the advice I'd give Robert here, I would say stop inviting your friends and family for two reasons. One, it's a crutch. And every time you go to that well, it takes your attention off of creative ways to get people out to the show. So just don't even invite them. Two, part of the reason why you don't even invite them is you're probably irritating them. And it becomes this thing like, oh man, here comes Robert. He's going to invite us to a show. I do not want to go. Everyone, what are we doing Friday so we can say we're busy? So just stop irritating them with that and ignore them. And force yourself to think outside of the box, because when everyone thinks about their friends and family, they start kind of focusing too much on that demographic and forget about people that will actually come and support their music. So that's what I would start by doing.
And when there's the outside validation of you having fan base beyond that group of people, your friends and family will then want to come to your shows.
And then start getting creative with things that you can do at your show that might interest people, like giveaways or, you know, I don't know, fun things that's fun for the audience to show up and have a good time around. I mean, because you're trying to get people interested in your event. Like we were talking about in the streaming portion about it being a attention economics. One of the conferences I was at recently, this company that does a lot of data research said that, you know, we're at a point where peak attention in the fact that people rarely sit and are ever even bored anymore because they've always have something taking up their attention with their phone in front of their face every waking moment. So it's really hard to get people's attention. So you got to be a little bit more creative and sell them on the idea of coming out to your show. It might be to get the ball rolling. It might be more than just, hey, we're a great band. Come see us play. Do something.
Well, yeah, because I've gotten into this thing where I play usually monthly in my hometown. And by and large, it's mostly the same group of people that come out every time. And if I played the same set or the same 45-minute set or even the same 2-hour set every time, it would really start to feel like a chore. So I do, like last month I did kind of a Halloween theme thing where all the songs were about monsters, murders, or mill towns. The month before, what was my thing the month before? Oh, it was a Tom Petty tribute. So I did 10 Tom Petty songs, you know, like amidst all this other music I was playing. But anyways, it's like, might seem gimmicky, but like when you do it, it makes the show fun. It makes it fun to promote, fun to plan for, like, so just make it a different kind of event every time.
And here's my other piece of advice. Look in your scene and get a giant list of bands where it would make sense for you to open for them. Doesn't matter if you feel like you're more established than them or you've been around longer or your music's better. Bands that have followings that you feel like their fans would also like you, and offer to be the opening band or the opening band, and offer your services to help say, like, we will get out and promote the show. I'll go hang flyers on every street pole in the city until, you know, I get in trouble for littering across the town. I will make sure this city knows about the show. If you offer those that kind of an excitement for promoting a show where you're the opening act and get on those bills, opening for other people, to me, that's a strategy that is extremely helpful for building a fan base instead of trying to go to the well with your friends. Then, see, when you use with the whole friends and family thing, you want to pull that lever when it really counts. So say you've got an album release show, or you've got a show that you're going to video, or you're using a lot of content, or there's just, you know, you're playing a very sought after slot at a really important venue. That's when you pull the friends and family lever and say, please, I know you haven't come to a show. I haven't asked you in years to come to a show. This is the one. We need everybody to come out in support to this one because it's a really big deal. Then you'll get the friends and family to come out, and it's worthwhile, and it helps kind of build some excitement for important gigs. So I hope that helps. We're going to go back to the phones, and here we go. They didn't leave their name, but it's a good call.
Hi, I'm a saxophonist, and I'm just breaking into the scene, I suppose you'd say. My question is, how do you determine fees? Should it be per hour? Should it be per set? Or how do you determine? Because I feel like I'm undercharging whenever I do an engagement. Thank you so much.
Chris, you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, and they're very unspecific because it's hard to make a determination like that. Like, for one, it depends where you live. If you're in New York City, it's going to be very different than if you're in Iowa City. And she said she's a saxophonist, right? So then there's all kinds of gigs you could be taking. There could be the kind of gig where you're really just like the, you know, the equivalent of like a session player. Like, you're hired to play for a wedding band or for, you know, someone's funk band, but you're really just hired, in which case then it makes sense to have some idea of what your rate is. And then there's like, maybe you have a jazz combo that's yours, or I don't know, there's so many different variables. And I think if you're really kind of at the start of that, lower your expectations and maybe be okay with, you know, the sort of thing where it's like, hey, we're playing at this restaurant tonight and here's what we're going to make and we're going to split it four or five ways or whatever. And then that's just what you get. If that seems exhausting or taxing on your time or finances, then I don't know. It's really tough to answer. But I just feel like, as someone who has played my own music and played at other people's music in all different capacities, there's no one answer. Is basically what I'm going to say.
If there's some particular venues that you're targeting that maybe have solo instrumentalists, you know, I mean, she could be playing saxophone to some looping stuff. I don't know. You might call those venues and ask if they have a standard rate they pay. I know my guitar teacher in college, he would play these gigs all the time, all over the city, like at a hotel or, you know, just these random gigs where you're kind of, could be background music, might be like a restaurant, or it could be more featured in a restaurant or something like that. But he would play these solo guitar gigs all the time. And it would vary. But if you see a particular venue having those people, it's probably a good chance that they have a set rate that they're willing to pay. So you might call them and just ask. Some sites like Gig Salad might be useful in trying to gauge what people want. I mean, sometimes it takes some trial and error. I know that artists typically ask too little. We always feel like we don't value ourselves as much as we should. So I see that happen a lot.
And here my advice was, lower your expectations.
Well, I think here's the thing. It's not undervaluing yourself, like, this is what I want for my time, but then being prepared that that person may not have properly set expectations and you may need to adapt. How about that?
Yeah, that's great. And you know, this reminds me of that tip that Gregory Hyde shared a couple years ago at our conference, where have a set rate in your mind and always say, you know, let's say it's $150 an hour or whatever. Say, I'm $150 an hour. Is that within your budget? Because then you're asking them, they can say yes or no in that moment. And if you see their eyes getting a little nervous and they say, not really, then you can say, well, what is in your budget? $100? You know, so then there's an open conversation about it and you're not shut off from the gig.
Yeah, usually it's good to let them counter with what is in their budget, because then it lets them kind of, they play their hand and you're like, okay, they wanted to pay $10, not worth it. You know, that, because not only is the rate that people are willing to pay an indicator of, you know, it could be an indicator of other things, like, hey, if they're only going to pay like $20 or thinking that a musician costs $20, the sound system's probably going to be crappy. The whole experience is probably going to be terrible. Now, there are some other, you know, there are exceptions to that rule, but, you know, a lot of times the money people are willing to pay is an indicator about how the overall night is going to go in general. So that it's a good way to kind of figure out, is it going to be worth my time? Maybe yes, maybe no. Maybe it's worth the good stories you'll have afterwards when it all comes crashing down.
Yeah, you'll have an answer to the question, what was your worst gig ever?
Yeah, yeah. If you still can't answer that question, you can keep looking. You can keep looking. All right. Well, we've got one more call. It's a quick one, so we'll finish up the calls and then go back to our last email.
Hola. Oh, thank you so much for your podcast. I listen to it quite religiously, and it's been a huge help. So, hey, I hear you talking about Spotify a lot and other platforms, but I haven't heard you mention SoundCloud in a while. Just wondering what you guys are feeling about SoundCloud. Is it worth paying the whatever, however many euros it is every month for the SoundCloud Pro I've been using? I'm wondering if it's really worthwhile. So I look forward to thoughts on that. Thank you. And this is Madeline Tasquin out of Berkeley, California.
Thanks for the call, Madeline. I'm guessing that she's going to UC Berkeley because she said euros. And as far as I know, the Bay Area is still a part of the United States. Not on the euro. I was just down there a couple of weeks ago and they were using dollars. So thanks for the call, Madeline. A part of the reason why we haven't talked about SoundCloud much lately, we've mentioned it in the news a few times, but is honestly, I wasn't sure if it'd be around at this point. There was like some serious consideration of shutting it down. So kind of just was waiting to see how that all played out before really diving in and encouraging artists to really start building a presence there again, just because it's really frustrating to build a following and use a platform and then find out it's all going to disappear.
Yeah, well, and SoundCloud, I feel like, is so genre dependent. You know, hip hop and EDM are big on there, and you know, lots of other kinds of genres, I feel like, almost have no use for it in a way. The only time I ever think to go on there to do anything with my own account is when I have a new single coming out or an album and I need to post it somewhere privately, but be able to share the music. Like, they make that super easy, you know? So if you're going to send it to bloggers or whoever needs to access it before the official release, they make that easy, but you can do that with the free SoundCloud service. So you don't even need to upgrade for that. Beyond that, I really don't know. I feel like I'm kind of in the similar boat as Kevin, because I just don't really use it.
Yeah, and I've used it in a similar fashion as Chris. That's usually when I show up to SoundCloud, is when I've got a track I want to only allow like press or people to hear it in advance without it being available publicly. I don't know if someone has some feedback or thoughts about the state of SoundCloud that's been using it and still having success. I know we did an episode about SoundCloud. It's been like a year and a half, 2 years now. But if someone has some updated feedback, I'd love to hear it. And yeah, so let us know. Well, we got one last email, and I think this one is pretty interesting. I even had to call in our own legal department to help me answer the question. All right, this email is from Anthony. I have a general legal question that I'm wondering if you'd be able to address or steer me towards the right resource. About a year ago, I was contacted by a major music supervisor in Los Angeles asking for rights to my master recording of a very popular song by a well-known band to be used in the season finale of what has now become a major series. Per my conversation with the music supervisor, and he has three bullet points. One, my cover version was found randomly on YouTube. Two, I was asked for clearance of the master. Three, permission was granted from the band whose song I covered. So the publishing was cleared is basically what that means. After months of waiting to hear back, I did some follow-up only to be told that their in-house composer had arranged and recorded a version similar to mine and that his version would be used in the finale, thus saving money for the company. In other words, they discovered my version, thought it was a good idea, and rather than have to pay me an unknown, they basically used my version as a template and made their own. I have all the messages documented and my version recorded, released, and available at least a year before the finale aired, available with dates on, like iTunes, CD Baby, YouTube, and CD. I'm wondering what rights I have here. I'm not sure why I waited so long to ask someone other than plain disappointment and not wanting to really think about it. Basically wondering if I'm owed anything for having the idea to cover the song in this way and actually thinking of the cover version idea. Thanks. So that's an interesting question. And I forwarded on to our in-house legal guy, Joel, to get an answer because honestly, I didn't know the answer. But before I get to the response from Joel, I will say that this could be a common problem. This is something that you need to be aware of as an independent artist who might have an interesting cover song out there. Basically, it goes like this. And it happened to me when I was pitching songs for CD Baby back in the day. I got approached by the company that was doing, I think it was for Marley and Me. I think it was that movie. And there was an interesting cover of a Nirvana song that they found on our website. And so I was negotiating with them on price, and they finally just basically said, look, let's just cut to the chase. We'll give you $5,000. If you need anything more than that, we're just going to do our own version of it. It's cheaper for us to just do our own version and own the master. So in that situation that I experienced, they were at least forthcoming in, you know, I think I asked for $10,000 because this artist was pretty established, and this cover version of the Nirvana song had sold quite well and had seen some activity in other places. And so they just came back and said, look, we'll just rip it off if you don't go for $5,000, basically is what they were saying. And then we'll own the master. So I'm guessing that in this case, that's exactly what happened. They just decided, look, why pay for this? I'll just whip up a version of this song right now from their in-house composer.
Which I have to say, I don't know what Joel's going to say about the law and the ability to copyright arrangements, but I just think that's really crappy. I mean, I understand the economics of it, all that stuff, but it's, even though it's not your song, it's still your take on it. There's still your creativity and your ideas in there. And if they're going to then just copy that, it seems unethical to me.
Well, the one thing my response to Anthony while I was waiting for Joel's response was that, one, he should follow up with them again and let them know that, you know, hey, this isn't right. And whatnot. And it could be, before he burns that relationship with that music supervisor, it could be that there was some miscommunication or a production assistant did something to cause this to happen. So it may not have been the instruction of the music supervisor saying, hey, you know what? I found this good version. You know, we can just have the in-house composer who's on salary anyway, just whip up a version. That'll be fine. That may not be how it went down. It could be how it went down, but it may not be. So it may have been someone being just stupid and not just trying to be to shaft the artist. But either way, it's wrong. So this is what Joel, our in-house counsel, said. He said, my take is this person should follow up with legal counsel to look into this further. A local volunteer lawyers for the arts, like in Oregon, there's a local volunteers Lawyers for the Arts organization, would love to look at this sort of thing. The real issue is what is protected by copyright. Experts call it the idea-expression dichotomy, where copyrights only protect expression, not ideas. For instance, copyright does not defend your idea for a movie about a shark attacking a village in New England, but it does protect your written expressed script for Jaws. I loved how I didn't know he was going to say Jaws, but I'm like, a shark attacking a village in New England?
Sharknado.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. This parallels music, where my idea to cover Springsteen's Ghost of Tom Joad? Is that what it is? Ghost of Tom Joad as a hard rock or classical piano song is not protected, but my recorded expressed cover of the song is protected. This matters here because the question is whether this company merely used your idea, not protected, or some of your expression, which is protected. Even with a cover song, you can change it enough that you add additional expressive parts, such as an additional melody that you get copyright protection for. If the company used parts of your expression, it could be infringement. This is way too nuanced to be answered without deep investigation, and why you should consult with an expert, such as a VLA, Volunteer Lawyers for the Arts, to help map out what rights you have and whether the company used any of those rights without your permission. So I say on the podcast all the time, I am not a lawyer, but Joel is a lawyer, and that's exactly what he said you should do.
It's interesting that this question came up on this episode, because earlier this week I was listening to a bunch of different slow piano versions of that song, Mad World. You know, that Tears for Fears released originally as kind of a upbeat electronic new wave thing, and then Gary Jules did the first slow version, and now there's all different versions of that version. And I was like, who's getting paid for this? Like, I know Tears for Fears is getting paid, but like, does the originator of that particular arrangement get any credit for that? And the similar thing with the Pixies, Where Is My Mind? There's like a ton of slow piano versions of that.
Yes. A TV show, The Leftovers, used it like crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I think in my conversation with Joel, he might have even referenced that Gary Jules song where all these people are covering the all these people are covering the Gary Jules version, and a lot of them probably think that's the original. So there is some sort of Gary Jules expression of that song that should be protected. How that works out with royalties is a follow-up question, but something I learned from this email from Joel is that there are organizations like Volunteer Lawyers for the Arts that would be happy to look into these kind of things for artists. So I don't know if there's these organizations in every state, but it's definitely worth looking into if there's an organization like this in your state and following up. It is pretty crappy that this could happen. I guarantee that if the situation that Anthony outlined in where the music supervisor approached him, it was pre-cleared, but then they ended up just going some other route. If they did it on purpose, in an attempt to just screw the artist out of having to pay them money, that they were probably thinking that they would never get caught. Now, I will say, having pitched a lot of songs to film and TV, music supervisors are hyper concerned with making sure they have all the rights properly tied down, because they'll lose their job instantly if they screw something up that causes a lawsuit. And sometimes they'll never get hired again. So they are very hyper aware. I've never met a music supervisor that I thought was being shady around sign off on rights and stuff like that. I've met a few that I don't think I would enjoy having a drink with that person. I just don't like them. But when it came down to signing off the rights, I felt like they were all above boards, because if they don't, they will lose their job. So my first take is that it was probably a mistake that somebody made. The music supervisor gave somebody some instructions. They did something, they misheard or did something wrong, and just had the composer record it. But it could have been nefarious, but I'm just saying that that's probably not where I'd start. Either way, you still have legal rights, and it's probably worth looking into, because if that show is a big hit show and your version is out there, it could be worth a lot of money.
And then just to say, I'm sorry that happened. I'm sorry that happened. That sounds, I understand the, you know, or early on he said, I just didn't ask this because I was so bummed. I get that. That sucks.
And just because it happened a while ago doesn't mean you still don't have legal rights. So I check out one of those organizations and hopefully they can help you. Well, thanks for all the calls and emails. Like I said, it was going to be a supersized episode of the podcast. I wanted to get through a lot of the backlog because there are so many good questions and calls. And because I want to encourage people to call and email with their holiday promotion tips and any other thoughts or comments you have about this episode or just anything in general going on with your music career. But we're heading into that holiday promotion season, and we always have a good time sharing various tips and ideas. Every year we get artists coming up with some great new ideas. You know, live streaming is a big popular thing now that seems to be on everyone's lips these days, talking about Facebook Live and YouTube Live and Instagram Live. So if you've got some interesting ideas around that, feel free to share. But just anything in general that you plan to do to get your music out in front of folks this holiday season, you can call our listener line at 360-524-2209. You can email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com or go to the website at cdbabypodcast.com and leave comments in the show notes.
And just to promote my music for a second, please check out my latest single, Irretrievable Beauty, on Spotify, Apple Music, Amazon, blah, blah, blah.
There you go. See, this whole hour and 40-minute podcast was just a scam to get people to hang around and then hear Chris promote his music.
Yeah, and don't just check it out. Save it. Add it to your playlist. Thumbs up it. Follow me.
Cool. All right. Well, I think that's going to do it. You know what's funny, Chris, when we have these long episodes?
What's funny?
That someone will complain that it was so long. I'm like, just stop listening.
Yeah, just press stop.
There's no test at the end.
Just unplug your earbuds.
Yeah. But anyway, I love long podcasts. Most of the podcasts I listen to are between an hour and 2 hours long, so it's good to listen to while driving. So anyway, we'll catch you next time. Take it easy.
See ya.
Bye.
Been listening to the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, USA.